Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses the impact of the tentative EU-Greek bailout agreement that inflicts more painful austerity measures but keeps Greece in the Eurozone. Dustin White of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, who talks about why he believes a recent Supreme Court ruling against the EPA in a mercury pollution case wasn't a victory for the coal industry. And Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, who explains why his group is calling for congressional hearings on the threat of domestic terrorism posed by white supremacist hate groups. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In late April, retired Marine Brigadier General Stephen Cheney welcomed members of the U.S. National Security Establishment and big military contractors to a symposium on security and climate change. Cheney's focus was on extreme weather and predicted surges in migration caused by global warming. According to General Cheney, who runs the American Security Project, climate change is already driving up internal and cross-border migration, with hotspots like Chad and Nigeria, which has led to the rise of the Boko Haram terrorist group. According to the news magazine Indies Times, Bangladesh is now the ground zero of climate change, as rising sea levels are set to displace 15 million people by the year 2050. Oxford University researcher Norman Myers projects there could be as many as 200 million climate refugees by the middle of this century. 2 years ago, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security drew up its Climate Action Plan, which warned that the U.S. southern border should be prepared for frequent short-term disaster-driven migration from Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. Already, the ongoing drought in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras is driving up the number of migrants crossing the U.S. border. In early June, the private company that runs Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico, was fined $557,000 for disclosing information related to nuclear weapon design. The company that runs Los Alamos National Laboratories also received a fine of $247,500 as a result of safety violations, which were not detailed by U.S. Department of Energy officials. According to the Center for Public Integrity, these government sanctions suggest the nuclear laboratories, under high scrutiny a decade ago for security breaches, are still having trouble safeguarding classified nuclear weapons information. In notices published by the Energy Department on June 5th, the National Nuclear Security Administration ominously stated that the breaches were serious enough to have an adverse effect on national security. The Commonwealth of Puerto Rico is the scene of the next big debt crisis, where the island has been mired in recession for 9 years. Puerto Rico currently is $72 billion in the red and has warned creditors it cannot pay. In recent years, much of the debt has been bought up by U.S. mutual funds, hedge funds, and wealthy investors. Unlike U.S. states and municipalities, the island's government cannot file for bankruptcy and restructure its debt unless Congress authorizes Puerto Rico access to bankruptcy courts. Since lucrative corporate tax breaks expired and dozens of companies left, over 1.5 million Puerto Ricans have fled the island over the last decade. In their wake, hundreds of public schools and small businesses have closed as the economic devastation continues to snowball. The current unemployment rate has risen to 12.4%, even as the sales tax recently jumped to 11%. While the Obama White House maintains that there will be no federal bailout for Puerto Rico, there are increased calls for Washington to intervene in a crisis which threatens the livelihood and welfare of the island's population. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Despite the Greek people's overwhelming rejection of more austerity measures in a July 5th national referendum, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras of the leftist Syriza party yielded to most of the demands of Eurozone creditors in high-stakes negotiations that concluded early in the morning of July 13th. in exchange for a third international bailout of some $96 billion. The Greek parliament is expected to approve painful tax hikes, reduce pension payments, and deep budget cuts. One possible silver lining in the deal is a vague reference to future debt relief, a position supported by the International Monetary Fund in a leaked report that warned unless Europe accepts the reality that Greece needs major debt relief, the IMF won't provide any more bailout funds. Although Prime Minister Tsipras and his party were elected in January on a pledge to resist more EU-imposed austerity, he must now convince members of his own party and the Greek people that the deal he agreed to was the only way forward for his country to avoid economic collapse and remain in the eurozone. But many in Greece are in a defiant mood after 5 years of harsh economic policies that have ushered in conditions where 40% of the nation's children live in poverty, infant mortality is skyrocketing, there's 25% unemployment, and a healthcare system that is on the brink of collapse. Your reporter spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses the impact of the tentative EU-Greek bailout agreement and how the deal may affect the growing anti-austerity movement, challenging neoliberal economic policies across Europe.
The European Central Bank did something that no central bank in history probably has ever done, and that was they created deliberately on June 28th a severe financial crisis, the one that did something that they hadn't done in 6 years of depression. They shut down the banking system of Greece. And so Tsipras had a choice, the Syriza government, which was to either agree to the deal or they could have a more severe crisis until the whole, including a real financial meltdown, and ultimately be pushed out of the euro probably as well. So that's why they surrender, the same reason why people pay ransom when their family is kidnapped. Now, that's not to say that there's no choice ever going forward, because obviously it is possible to leave the euro. The trouble is that Tsipras had promised in the run-up to the referendum that they weren't voting, people who voted no weren't voting to leave the euro. So at the same time, they did vote to reject the austerity. So he had to choose one or the other, and I think he chose for the moment what the majority of people in Greece preferred, as bad as it was. That doesn't mean they're going to prefer that a year or even a few months from now.
Mark, I wanted to find out your take on this. What, if anything, did Prime Minister Tsipras win regarding debt relief? Because there was some vague mention of debt relief, but nothing, as far as I read in the report, specific about telling the Greek people that there's a light at the end of the tunnel here.
Well, there is debt relief going to come, and I think that's because the IMF and the U.S. really was the one who forced this, because the IMF has a board of directors and a board of governors, and that includes not just the U.S. Treasury Department, although that's the dominant voice for most of the world, but with regard to Europe, the executive directors from Europe also have a voice. But the U.S. insisted, and therefore the IMF insisted, that there had to be debt relief. So the government did win that, because in the last deal, there was no movement on debt relief at all. So that is kind of what happened. I mean, the U.S. was involved in these negotiations, and they insisted on debt relief. You have to read a little between the lines to see that, but it's very clear. The main issue is to be able to recover, have the economy recover, and bring down the mass unemployment and get out of the depression that they're still in. And that's where this program is probably going to fail, because it's still squeezing them too much. Even if everything goes through this week and Greece does the things that the European officials are demanding, they're still squeezing too much. So it's still a mess.
Mark, how do you think this agreement that's been hammered out, this tentative agreement, how do you think that'll affect the growing anti-austerity movement across Europe, specifically in a country like Spain, where the Podemos party and a powerful new anti-austerity party is a real contender in upcoming national elections there.
Well, I think that's one reason why the Eurozone officials were so stubborn and brutal here. They can see what's happening in Spain. This is, you know, Podemos is close to leading in the polls now, and they didn't even exist a year and a half ago. So the Eurozone officials and the general elite of Europe, which includes the social democratic parties, unfortunately, that's why they lost so much support in Spain and Greece. The social democratic left has kind of collapsed in most of Europe now because of the austerity, because they endorsed it. So all of these people, all of the establishment doesn't want to see them have anything that looks like a success. So in a way, I think the surrender in Greece probably helped Podemos a little bit, because if they had gone out of the Eurozone at this time, things would have gotten worse there before they got better, and they would have used it to scare everybody in Spain. Unfortunately, it still doesn't look like a victory for them. The referendum definitely helped Podemos, but then this won't necessarily. So it'll really depend on what happens in the next few months. If it looks like there's still going to be some resistance, and that the battle's not over.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, whose forthcoming book is titled Failed: What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. Find more analysis on the Greek debt crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As it wrapped up this year's docket, the U.S. Supreme Court on June 29th ruled against one of the Obama administration's key environmental initiatives that required coal-fired power plants to clean up mercury and other toxic emissions. In its 5-4 ruling, the court found that the Environmental Protection Agency had not considered the cost of its regulation at the beginning of its rulemaking process, even though it did so later on. The decision in the case known as Michigan versus Environmental Protection Agency did not overturn the rule, but sent it back to the EPA for a rewrite. Many coal-fired power plants across the U.S. have already closed or are scheduled to shut down due to a combination of pressure from environmental groups and economic factors. Others have installed scrubbers to clean up the air pollutions the plants produce. Overall, coal production in Appalachia is on the decline, and the value of stock in some of the nation's largest companies, like Alpha Natural Resources and Arch Coal, have tumbled to just pennies a share. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dustin White, a community organizer with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition in West Virginia, which was one of 13 citizens groups in 8 states that sued American Electric Power Company in 1999 over the issue of mercury pollution. The suit charged that the company violated the new source review requirements of the Clean Air Act and should be required to clean up 11 of its coal-burning power plants in 5 states, 6 of them in West Virginia, in order to comply with the act. The case was settled in 2007 when the company agreed to cut 813,000 tons of pollutants annually at an estimated cost of more than $4.6 billion, pay a $15 million penalty, and spend $60 million on projects to mitigate the adverse effects of its past excess emissions. Here, Dustin White shares his view that the Supreme Court decision against the EPA in this case is not as big a setback for coal communities as it first appeared.
Well, I know early on a lot of the media was trotting that this was a win for the coal industry, this decision by the Supreme Court against the EPA's air rule. But honestly, we don't believe it really has that much of an impact. There have been, you know, a lot of power plants are being phased out and scrubbers have already been installed. And from what we're seeing on the ground here, you know, the coal industry is pretty much done for. The stocks for some of the top coal producing companies are going down steadily. And no matter the decision, it's still not going to affect the downturn of the coal industry. And that's, you know, another kind of downside to the Supreme Court's decision is there's still the carbon production, you know, even though their decision was based on mercury limits, you know, all this pollution that goes into the air has an impact on, you know, climate disruption. And we're just going to continue to see these major weather events like derechos and massive hurricanes and severe tornado seasons as long as we keep burning coal as electricity.
Just today, I heard on the news that natural gas has overtaken coal as the number one source of electricity in the U.S., 31% to 30%. And, you know, that's a tremendous drop from when coal provided half the electricity in this country, and that wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, we're seeing, and this has been a long time running, that a lot of the coal that's used for electricity production is no longer accessible, at least in the Appalachian region. And the natural gas industry has provided, you know, a very strong kind of battle against the coal industry for what they consider a cheaper form of energy for electricity production. We see that as, you know, one of the major turnabouts is the fact that there are other resources that are coming out, both fossil fuel-wise, which we really don't like, and renewables that are actually competing and beating out coal for electricity generation now.
And I wanted to ask you about that, because I know it was true that in West Virginia, and maybe Kentucky too, almost all electricity used in the state was generated from coal, which of course would increase the detrimental health impacts for residents of those states. Is that still true?
Yeah, as for the states themselves, we are still using coal-fired power plants. That seems to be one of the last, you know, holding points that the states that where they actually extract the coal are still using coal to produce the electricity. But we hope that as folks wise up to the lessening demand of coal and other resources, preferably renewable resources and sustainable energy, that we too will make a transition away from coal-fired power plants.
Dustin White, let's talk a minute about the health impacts, both of coal production and the burning of coal. There have been a growing number of studies showing serious and even fatal health problems, including elevated rates of birth defects and cancer in mining communities. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah. Basically, from cradle to grave, coal is very detrimental to human health. From the moment that it's extracted from the ground to the point that it's burned, it produces toxins that can actually harm the health of communities, either communities where it's mined or communities where it's burned, or even throughout the transportation project. Just the coal dust alone from coal trucks and coal trains can actually harm people's lungs. A lot of the extraction process harms water quality, and for regions that still depend on groundwater for water for their homes, it creates toxic levels in their groundwater that harms their health. And then right to the burning processes, you know, we're seeing health studies coming out now that talk about ultrafine particulates, which are particulates smaller than the EPA regulates that can actually go in and penetrate the cell membrane in the human body and cause illnesses. For over 100 years now, the industry has pretty much raped and pillaged, and we will be paying the legacy costs for this mining for decades to come. Even once coal is done with, we will still be trying to clean up the mess that they produced. And when a lot of companies go bankrupt, they're no longer responsible for their cleanup, and that goes on to the taxpayers to clean up the water pollution and things like that.
That was Dustin White, an organizer with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. Find more news and commentary on the continuing campaign to eliminate coal pollution by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The June 17th cold-blooded murder of 8 black parishioners and their pastor at Charleston, South Carolina's historic Emmanuel AME Church by an avowed white supremacist provoked anger, mourning, and protest. The alleged assailant, Dylan Roof, wrote about his racist views that motivated the violence on a website
featuring photos of the 21-year-old posing with Confederate flags, a symbol of the bloody Civil War insurrection waged to preserve black slavery across the South. South Carolina's civil rights community responded to the murders by renewing their decades-long demand to remove the Confederate flag flying in front of the Confederate Soldiers' Monument on the grounds of the state capitol in Columbia. It wasn't long before local and national politicians, businesses, and celebrities joined the campaign to take down the state's Confederate flag. That gathering pressure rapidly gained momentum, and the state's legislature quickly passed, and Republican Governor Nikki Haley signed a bill to remove the flag on July 9th, moving it to a museum. The success of the campaign to remove the Confederate flag in South Carolina and vocal support to take it down in other states was an important victory for civil rights activists. But the current threat of violence presented by white supremacist ideology that inspired Dylann Roof is an issue that was largely ignored in the national debate about the Confederate flag. Your reporter spoke with Mark Potok, senior fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center, who explains why his group is calling for congressional hearings on the threat of domestic terrorism posed by white supremacist hate groups.
In the aftermath of the massacre, really what has been remarkable is the criticism and really more or less full-scale assault on the Confederate battle flag. You know, I think that's significant, actually. I think it's real, and it's happening across the South, certainly not everywhere, but that movement, if it's a movement, is really fairly alive. Where I live, in Alabama, in Montgomery, Alabama, the capital, they've taken down a Confederate flag from a very similar position, in a row of flags, not over the Capitol dome, but right next door. We're seeing monuments that have been voted down in places like Birmingham, which, of course, not so many years ago was known as Bombingham because of all the Klan bombings of civil rights workers and so on. A number of other places are doing very similar things. Maybe the most interesting is in Memphis, where they are about to dig up the body of Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was a big hero of the South during the Civil War for the Confederacy. He was a lieutenant general. And that is, I think, important. So all of that is going on. At the same time, I think that there has been a kind of willful attempt on the part of many, especially on the political right, to look away from the real political motivations of Dylann Roof, the killer in Charleston, or the alleged killer in Charleston. I say that because, almost immediately after the massacre, we began to hear personalities on Fox News and that sort of thing describing Dylann Roof as a drug-addled lunatic, someone who is mentally ill. And this we hear very, very consistently from the political right in this country, that, you know, you've got jihadists. Well, they are real terrorists, people who will, you know, blow you up and kill your children, sort of rape your wife and so on. But anything from the right, and there has been a whole lot from the right in the last 10 years or so in terms of political violence, is somehow just mentally ill people.
Mark, your organization has called for congressional hearings on the continuing threat of domestic terrorism, namely right-wing hate groups and white supremacist organizations that continue to thrive throughout the South and throughout the entire country. Your organization has done many years' worth of investigations and reports and documentation of the threat these groups present. Tell our listeners why you think a congressional hearing on this present threat is warranted right now at this moment.
Well, because despite the fact that we have a relatively liberal Democratic administration, and many nice words are said by that administration with respect to paying equal attention to threats from foreign sources, especially jihadist threats, and threats from the domestic radical right, especially the white supremacist radical right, that hasn't been the case, in fact. There was, for instance, a countering violent extremism conference early this year at the White House, hosted by Barack Obama. And much was made in the run-up to that conference of we were going to look equally at all kinds of terrorism, and that's not what happened. In fact, what happened was there was really nary a mention of anything other than jihadist, than Islamist terrorism. And, you know, there are a number of other things that have happened ever since a report from the Department of Homeland Security was leaked in 2009 on the rise of the radical right and was immediately attacked and pilloried by conservative groups like the American Legion and so on. We have seen DHS back away from this as well, seeing it as a kind of political hot potato. So under Janet Napolitano, DHS really did some awful things in terms of being scared off by conservatives and unable to face the threat squarely. So all that to say that, yeah, my boss, the CEO, the president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Richard Cohen, is going to testify, in fact, before the Committee on Homeland Security in the House. And from what I understand, this is exactly what he's going to talk about, the necessity to pay attention to all sources of terrorism. And, you know, let me say something obvious. I mean, we don't in any way discount the very real threat of al-Qaeda, of ISIS, and so on. I mean, these are incredible organizations. Al-Qaeda murdered 3,000 Americans in a single day. So they're no joke, to be sure. But what we're saying is obviously, look, I mean, in fact, since 9/11, more Americans have been murdered by people on the domestic radical right than jihadists of any stripe, either homegrown or foreign, and we need to pay attention. And perhaps just to sort of underline that for our listeners, just a few years ago, there was a plot to set on by a man who was a confirmed neo-Nazi, belonged to one of the major neo-Nazi groups called the National Alliance. You know, he built an IED, an improvised explosive device, and set it on the path of Martin Luther King Day marchers in January of that year in Spokane, Washington. And had not a passerby noticed that early, and had not the police forces really very heroically dismantled the thing, you know, there might have been several hundred people dead, possibly even 1,000. So this is a real thing, and that's the point we're trying to make. There seems to be a great reluctance to call the radical right what it is, and that is a very real and substantial political movement that uses mass murder, among other things, to push its case.
Terrorism, in other words.
Yes, that's right, terrorists.
That was Mark Potok, senior fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center. For more views on the threat posed by white supremacist terrorist groups, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.